Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, February 4th. Let's begin with the front page. From Decatur, Tony Reed. We have a photo of residents filing into an already overflowing room at the start of the Decatur City Council meeting voting to approve the Broadwing Energy development on Monday, February 2nd. Power plant advances. Energy Decatur. Environmentalists object to carbon capture plans. The Decatur City Council brushed aside environmentalists' concerns Monday night to approve massive infrastructure projects that will open the way for a trailblazing natural gas-fired power station that generates steam and power and captures its own pollution. A company called Broadwing Energy, LLC, plans to begin construction this year on the project to be located at 2903 North Brush College Road, which has an economic impact City Manager Melissa Hahn values at $1 billion. The council voted 6-1 to enter a development agreement with Broadwing that will make the city responsible for the construction of a massive new water main feeding the power station, which needs millions of gallons a day of Lake Decatur water. This new main will stretch from the area of Martin Luther King Jr. Drive and East Garfield Avenue out to Brush College Road near Hubbard Avenue. The price tag just for the engineering work is more than $1 million, but Broadwing has agreed to be on the hook for all design and installation costs. Council members also agreed to another deal, which will see them split the estimated $24 million fee for construction and land easements needed for the building of a sewer lift station and other water handling facilities as part of the project. Hahn said water fees and revenues paid to the city from the power station should see taxpayers' $12 million share of that bill flooding back at a rate that will cover the full cost within just 2 years of the power plant becoming operational. Broadwing's power station breaks new ground by using technology pioneered by Archer Daniels Midland Company to safeguard the atmosphere by pumping CO2 greenhouse gases underground. Objectors claim this is an unsafe technology that threatens drinking water supplies, such as Lake Decatur, with contamination, and point to past leaks that have already been a problem at ADM's CO2 wells in the city. Decatur resident Manley Mallard, a former Millikan University professor and member of the Illinois People's Action Pressure Group, spoke for many in the audience when he said CO2 capture wasn't safe. Carbon capture is an unproven technology, he warned. And although ADM promises it is safe and permanent, it is neither. But Jonathan Weens, the CEO of Low Carbon Infrastructure, the company behind Broadwing, urged the council to grasp the opportunity being offered to them by the project. Millions of dollars in future water rate revenues, more than 700 construction jobs, and up to 50 highly full-time paid jobs running the completed plant with its gas turbine. And the customers already lined up for the power. They include ADM, but with the majority of electricity produced going to Google, which needs it to feed data centers fueling increased AI applications. And if we don't put that turbine here in Decatur, it's going to go to another town, right? Weens told the council. So the opportunity is now. We want to mobilize in the fall on the site. We want to start construction, and we want to get going. This is real. He was backed up by a squad of visiting speakers urging the council to give the green light. They included Mark Densler, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and Nicole Bateman, president of the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County. One surprise speaker was Will Wetzel, a member of the Decatur School Board. He spoke of a recent damming report which warned Decatur's school-age population was facing catastrophic decline fueled by a deteriorating economic and jobs climate. It looks like we're in a death spiral, he told the council. The good news, however, is that by working together we can reverse this. He urged the city to grab an opportunity that will bring jobs and revenue to an area that needs it badly. Councilman Pat McDaniel said, while there may be concerns, the right vote was to approve Broadwing. Decatur has turned down too many things over the years and regretted it, he said. I will be supporting this because it provides jobs and opportunity. Councilman David Horn was in favor, but had some serious concerns. He said major questions about potential revenue for the city, like whether a tax on consumption of natural gas fueling the plant will apply. He said such a tax could add up to $500 million in revenue over the 30-year lifespan of Broadwing, and the vote should be tabled because city staff does not know the answer to a $500 million question. But after a vote to table the issue failed 4-3, Horn joined the majority in greenlighting the whole project. The councilman said concerns remained about sequestration and increased water demand on a lake dealing with recent drought conditions, but added, "Ultimately, Broadwing Energy Center is a potential global model for how fossil fuel emissions can be reduced, and global warming is a substantial threat to human well-being." Again from our front page, from Scott Perry, Indicator. Elections. Early voting starts Thursday. Candidates for U.S. House, Senate, County Clerk, Sheriff to be decided. Early voting for the March 17th primary begins Thursday, February 5th. In Macon County, in-person voting will take place at the Macon County Annex Building, 151 West Wood Street, Decatur. Regular hours are 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., weekdays through March 6th, and 8:30 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, March 9th through 13th, and Monday, March 16th. There will also be weekend hours as the election nears, 9 a.m. to noon Saturday, March 7th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday, March 8th, and 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, March 14th and 15th. Vote-by-mail ballots will be mailed beginning February 5th. Request a vote-by-mail ballot at macon county.illinois.gov or at the Macon County Annex Building during operation hours. To be considered for counting, mail-in ballots must be postmarked on or before March 17th and received at the clerk's office by March 31st. Because of changes in when a letter is postmarked, voters are encouraged to mail a ballot at least a week before the election or request a manual postmark at a post office counter. Ballots also can be placed in the secure drop box outside the Macon County. Many benefits, but also come with responsibility. County Clerk Josh Tanner said, noting the deadlines and the post office changes. Those with additional questions about the election can call Macon County Voter Registration at 217-424-1309. Voters across the county will decide who will represent the Republicans on the November ballot for County Clerk. Those candidates are Republicans Kurt Younghouse and Marsha Webb. The winner will compete against Democrat Brian Smith to replace Tanner, who is not seeking re-election. There is a race for sheriff, even though it may not look that way on the ballot. That's because Sheriff Jim Root will be the only candidate named on the ballot above a line indicating a write-in. Shane Beck, a deputy in Root's department, registered as a write-in candidate after he was removed from the ballot for failing to number his election paperwork. There is no Democrat on the primary ballot. There is one contested primary race for a seat on the county board. In District 1, incumbent Democrat Vivian Goodman is being challenged by Stephanie King. Elsewhere in the county, some voters will decide who will represent the party in Springfield and Washington, D.C. In the 15th Congressional District, U.S. Representative Mary Miller is being challenged for the Republican nomination by Judy Bowlby and Ryan Tabrog. The winner will be challenged in November by one of four Democrats, Jennifer Todd, Randy Raley, Paul Davis, or Kyle Nudo. In the 13th Congressional District, U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski is being challenged for the Democrat nomination by Dylan Blaha. The winner will be challenged by Republican Jeff Wilson or Joshua Lloyd. On the state level, Frank Lesko is seeking the Republican nomination for the 48th Senate District against write-in Shane Michael Bouvet and the opportunity to go against incumbent Senator Doris Turner. On the House side of the Capitol, Republican Representative Brad Halbrook is being challenged by John Hogg on the Republican ballot for the 107th District. There is no Democrat on the primary ballot. As for statewide races, voters have a slate candidates on both sides of the aisle for U.S. Senate to replace the retiring Dick Durbin and governor. There also is a contested race for Republican Secretary of State and Democrat Comptroller. The general election is November 3rd. From our local news page, Tony Reed in Decatur. Decatur teen faces robbery charge. Police said they surrounded a Decatur home Sunday evening and arrested a 15-year-old boy, accused of trying to rob a victim at gunpoint after luring them through a Facebook marketplace scam. Sergeant Brandon Rolfs with the Decatur Police Department said the 19-year-old male victim had driven all the way from Brownstown believing he was going to buy a PlayStation 5 game system for $215. He had arranged to meet the seller in the 900 block of West Cushing Street around 7:30 p.m. and had arrived as a passenger in a car with three friends. He then saw the boy standing in a front yard and got out to approach him. The victim showed the suspect that he had the money in his hand, and the suspect pulled out a black Glock semi-automatic pistol with an extended magazine and demanded the victim's cash, Rolfe said. The victim yelled "gun" and dove back into his friend's car, which then sped away. Patrol officers flooded into the area in response to a 911 call from the victim and set about tracking down the alleged robber. Officers located some video surveillance, and through that, tracing footprints in the snow and speaking to witnesses, they were eventually led to a house in the 1400 block of North Poole Street, right there in that same neighborhood, Rolfe said. They surrounded the address, ordered subjects inside to come out of the house, and eventually did a search of the property. The 15-year-old suspect was identified, and a weapon matching the description of the gun used in the robbery was seized. The boy was booked on preliminary charges of the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon and attempted armed robbery. He was detained in juvenile detention. And the juvenile that we arrested was also wanted on an active arrest warrant since October of last year for an incident involving the aggravated discharge of a firearm, Rolfe said. He also pointed out that the address where the boy was found was also known to police through previous investigations and encounters. Rolfe warned Facebook market buyers and anyone doing deals over the internet to always arrange meetings at safe, well-monitored public locations. The foyer of the Decatur Public Decatur Police Department, for example, is designated as a location for such transactions and has 24/7 video surveillance. A good deal isn't worth jeopardizing your safety over, Rolfe said. And just because you have a friend or somebody with you, that doesn't mean that a crime won't be committed. And if it is such a good deal, it's worth going somewhere safe. And if somebody is a motivated seller or buyer, they will meet you there. Again from Decatur, Hahn makes Decatur history. First woman gets city manager job in 4-3 council vote. From Tony Reed. Melissa Hahn is now in the driving seat as Decatur's first female city manager. Formal approval came at Monday's council meeting, but it turned into a bit of a baptism by fire. The issue of officially hiring her for the job was sandwiched in between prolonged public comments over the new controversial approval of a new billion-dollar power station project for the city and an intense council debate that led to that approval. It was one of the first major decisions Hahn has had to shepherd through the council, and there was incoming criticism from Councilman David Horn. He raised questions about whether Hahn's professional staff knew what they were doing as regards all aspects of the power station project, especially when it comes to potential revenue. But he did ultimately vote for the Broadwing Energy Center, which had Hahn's blessing. Horn had earlier voted to approve Hahn as city manager, but the vote was not unanimous. The lone holdout here was Councilwoman Consuelo Cruz, who made it clear she had no beef with Hahn herself, but didn't like the hiring process that chose her. Cruz said that process was flawed. Decatur city government has insufficient written policies and processes that protect and promote fair wages and employment opportunities, she told the council. Policies which include a scorecard rubric and other procedures to reduce affinity bias must be created for future hiring processes. Affinity bias is defined as the unconscious tendency to favor job candidates who share similar backgrounds, interests, experiences, and even personality traits as the person or persons doing the hiring. There were more rumblings of discontent when council members, having approved Hahn for the job, had to ratify her employment agreement, which locks in a starting salary of $225,000. Cruz voted no on this one, too, and was joined by Horn and Councilman Dennis Cooper. and so the contract was approved by just one vote, 4-3. Cooper emphasized he had no problem with Hahn herself and said he believed she would bring success to our city in ways that we have not experienced in the past, but he told her effectively that he thought she was being paid too much. I was not in favor of the negotiated wages and salaries, he said. I think there was some inappropriateness done regarding the wages that we ended up putting it into that particular contract. Horn had issues with some of the contract wording, highlighting a section that stipulates city managers must maintain a permanent residence in the city. This had been a flashpoint with Hahn's predecessor in the job, Tim Gleason, who never found a home in the city that suited him. Mayor Julie Moore Wolfe had explained in a previous Herald and Review story that Gleason was looking for something nice by the lake and hadn't managed to find it. Horn had raised questions about this and many other things, and Gleason said his resignation had been fueled by what he saw as the councilman's unreasonable behavior. At Monday's meeting, Horn wanted to know whether the council had grounds to fire Hahn if she violated obligations like the residency clause or other requirements listed in the contract language, which includes provisions such as keeping the mayor and council fully informed of city matters. City Corporation Counsel Wendy Morthland said that she could not get into a debate with Horn about such details that would effectively make her a legal referee between the council and the city manager. So I am not able ethically to answer that question, she told Horn. The councilman then wanted to know what attorney was involved in drawing up the employment agreement. Morthland replied that it was handled by the search firm that had overseen the candidate hiring process, and the contract terms were the standard language similar to previous city manager contracts. Horn still wasn't happy. So if this was vague in previous contracts, then it continues to be vague, he said. That prompted Moore Wolfe to step in. If that's your opinion, she told him, before calling for the contract vote. However, the new city manager's tenure works out with the city. Her contract is very specific in one area, requiring her not to say anything unpleasant about how it ends. Upon termination of employment, city manager will make all reasonable efforts to ensure city is not subjected to disparaging comments or adverse publicity, the contract carefully stipulates. Now, part one from our opinion page, A New World Order, from Peter Harris. Harris is an associate professor of political science at Colorado State University. He wrote this for The Conversation. U.S. retreat doesn't have to make world left less safe. America's role in the world is changing following President Donald Trump's efforts to take over Greenland and his visibly strained relations with traditional allies in Europe and elsewhere. But how much will the world change if America's stance is different? Some scholars of international relations argue that because Washington has been central to global governance for so long, Trump's America First turn, suggesting isolationism on some issues and unilateral action on others, spells the end of international order as we've known it. The most pessimistic analysts caution that the long period of relative world calm since World War II, due to U.S. leadership, is coming to a close. They forecast a more chaotic world. But I see some grounds for optimism. The world can become a more just, stable, and secure place, despite the diminishment of American leadership. For the remaining 3 years of Trump's presidency, all bets are off. Trump is difficult to predict. The raid on Venezuela and Trump's oscillation between threatening and negotiating with Iran provide additional examples of the Republican president's volatile maneuvers. But the long-term trends are clear. The U.S. is losing its enthusiasm and capacity for global leadership. The rest of the world can assume that after Trump, America's participation in world affairs will decline. His recent actions suggest America's security guarantees to others will be more dubious, its markets less accessible, and its support for international institutions weaker. Does this mean a cascade of disorder for smaller nations? Perhaps, but not necessarily. U.S. foreign policy and its wars and actions abroad have sparked criticism for decades. Still, the prospect of U.S. retrenchment understandably causes anxiety for those who have long sheltered under America's security umbrella. Once U.S. forces spread around the globe have decamped to the continental U.S., the argument goes, not much will stop large countries such as Russia and China from steamrolling their vulnerable neighbors in Europe and East Asia. This is overly pessimistic. America's alliance commitments and vast military deployments date from the early Cold War of the 1950s, an era that bears few similarities with today. Back then, U.S. forces were needed to deter the Soviet Union and China from attacking their neighbors, who were almost uniformly weak and impoverished following World War II. Today, the European members of NATO and America's allies in Asia are among the world's wealthiest countries. These governments are easily rich enough to afford the sort of national militaries needed to deter potential aggressors and uphold stability in their respective regions. Indeed, they can likely do a better job of securing themselves than the U.S. manages on their behalf. Will the world become poorer and perhaps more dangerous if global economic integration falls by the wayside? This is a reasonable concern given the standard view that free trade leads to economic growth that helps foster world peace. But it is wrong to assume the worst. Instead of accepting that globalization is irreversibly in retreat, governments will likely relearn the benefits of economic integration and defend an open world economy, even absent U.S. leadership. Nations such as Canada, Japan, Australia, and the members of the European Union obviously lack the overwhelming military power and economic clout of the U.S., but they could choose instead to implement a more collective approach to global leadership. There will be war and suffering in the future, just as there has been war and suffering under U.S. leadership. The question is whether the international system will become more violent and unstable in the absence of U.S. leadership and military dominance. It well might, but the international community shouldn't resign itself to fatalism. The U.S. has lost influence. The silver lining is that more countries, including America's friends and allies, might rediscover their own capacity to shape world affairs. The post-American era is up for grabs. We'll read the second half of the opinion page in the second half hour. From our food page, we have Get the Party Started, crowd-pleasing dips to add to the Super Bowl snack table. These seven legendary layers are classic game day fare for a reason. As far as classic party dips go, seven-layer dip ranks among the very best. Carefully composed and colorfully striped, it's no wonder this dip is a key player on the tailgate snack table. It's everything you love about a taco, from the refried beans and guacamole to sour cream and pico de gallo, served dip style. It's also one of the easiest dips to make, but can be simplified even further with smart grocery shortcuts such as canned refried beans and store-bought salsa. And we also have a recipe for the million-dollar dip. It will instantly become the star of any gathering, exactly what you need, rich and indulgent, combining cream cheese and tangy mayonnaise with sharp cheddar, smoky bacon, and toasted almonds. For tips and swaps, and the complete ingredient list and instructions, see the in-print version of the Decatur Herald and Review food page, B5. From our national and world news page, digest. Clinton's finalized deal for Epstein testimony, Washington. Former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reached an agreement Tuesday with House Republicans to testify in a House investigation into Jeffrey Epstein this month, bowing to the threat of a contempt of Congress vote against them. Hillary Clinton will testify before the House Oversight Committee on February 26th, and Bill Clinton will appear February 27th. It will mark the first time that lawmakers compelled a former president to testify. The arrangement comes after months of negotiating between the two sides, as Republicans sought to make the Clintons a focal point in a House committee's investigation into Epstein, a sex offender who killed himself in a New York jail in 2019, and Ghislaine Maxwell, his former girlfriend. From Kyiv, Ukraine, Russia launches attack on Ukraine infrastructure. Russia carried out a major overnight attack on Ukraine in what President Volodymyr Zelensky said Tuesday broke a commitment to halt striking energy infrastructure as the country is prepared for more talks on ending Moscow's four-year-old full-scale invasion. The bombardment included hundreds of drones and a record 32 ballistic missiles, wounding at least 10 people. It specifically took aim at the power grid, Zelensky said, as part of what Ukraine says is Moscow's ongoing campaign to deny civilians light, heat, and running water during the coldest winter in years. Taking advantage of the coldest days of winter to terrorize people is more important to Russia than diplomacy, Zelensky said. From Minnesota, immigration enforcement. Sources describe more departures at U.S. Attorney's Office. From the Associated Press in Minneapolis. Agents draw guns, arrest activists. Immigration officers drew guns and arrested some activists who followed their vehicles Tuesday in Minneapolis, a sign that tensions haven't eased since the departure last week of a high-profile commander. At least one person who had an anti-ICE message on clothing was handcuffed while face down on the ground. An Associated Press photographer witnessed the arrests. Federal agents in the Twin Cities lately have conducted more targeted immigration arrests at homes and neighborhoods rather than staging in parking lots. The convoys are harder to find and less aggressive. Alerts in activist group chats have been more about sightings than immigration-related detainments. Several cars followed officers through South Minneapolis after there were reports of them knocking at homes. Officers stopped their vehicles and ordered activists to come out of a car at gunpoint. Agents told journalists at the scene to stay back and threatened to use pepper spray. The Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not reply to requests for comment. Meanwhile, a new wave of departures is ripping through the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota, where additional federal prosecutors are leaving at the time of mounting frustration with the Trump administration's stepped-up immigration enforcement and the Justice Department's response to federal agents shooting and killing civilians, two people familiar with the matter said Tuesday. The latest departures are on top of a half-dozen attorneys who left the office last month amid disagreements over the Justice Department's response to the killing of Renee Good by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer. At least one supervisory agent in the FBI's Minneapolis office is known to have resigned last month as well. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported Monday evening that eight lawyers have since departed the office or announced plans to do so. A person familiar with the matter, who spoke on condition of anonymity, confirmed that this number was correct and that more departures were likely. Another person also confirmed a new wave of departures in the office. From Washington, D.C., Associated Press. President demands $1 billion payment from Harvard. In social media post, he accuses school of behaving very badly. President Donald Trump demanded $1 billion payment from Harvard University to end his prolonged standoff with the Ivy League campus, doubling the amount he sought previously, as both sides appear to move further from reaching a deal. The president raised the stakes on social media Monday night, saying Harvard has been behaving very badly. He said the university must pay the government directly as part of a deal, something Harvard opposed. Trump's comments on social media came in response to a New York Times report saying the president dropped his demand for a financial payment, lowering the bar for a deal. Trump denied he was backing down. Harvard officials did not immediately comment. Trump's outburst appears to leave both sides firmly entrenched in a conflict that Trump previously said was nearing an end. Last June, Trump said a deal was just days away. He later said an agreement was being finalized that would require Harvard to put $500 million toward the creation of a series of trade schools. But that deal appears to have fallen apart. Today in history. On this date in 1789, electors unanimously chose George Washington to be the first president of the United States. In 1801, John Marshall took office as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, a position he would hold for 34 years. On this date in 1945, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin began a wartime conference at Yalta. On this date in 1976, more than 23,000 people died when a severe earthquake struck Guatemala with a magnitude of 7.5. In 2004, Facebook had its beginnings as Harvard student Mark Zuckerberg launched the Facebook. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 4th. Please stay tuned.